Chapter 12. Merely intervals of labor, but hours of study every day over the gourmandizing science, who, like alchemists, have let their fortunes go, guinea by guinea, into the all-devouring pot, who, ruined as they sometimes are, never get a guinea by chance, but they will have a plate of peace in May with it, or a little feast of ortolans, or a piece of Gloucester salmon, or one more flask from their favorite claret bin. It is not the ruined gastronomist that I would advise a person to select as his table master, for the opportunities of peculation would be too great in a position of such confidence, such complete abandonment of one man to another. A ruined man would be making bargains with the tradesman. They would offer to cash bills for him, or send him opportune presents of wine, which he could convert into money, or bribe him in one way or another. Let this be done, and the profession of table master is ruined. Snorter and Poxon may almost as well order their own dinners, as be at the mercy of a gastronomic agent whose faith is not beyond all question. A vulgar mind, in reply to these remarks regarding the gastronomic ignorance of Snorter and Poxon, might say, "True, these gentlemen know nothing of household economy, being occupied with other more important business elsewhere. But what are their wives about? Lady Poxon in Harley Street has nothing earthly to do but to mind her poodle and her mantua makers and housekeepers' bills. Mrs. Snorter in Belford Place, when she has taken her drive in the park with the young ladies, may surely have time to attend to her husband's guests and preside over the preparations of his kitchen, as she does worthily at his hospitable mahogany." To this I answer, that a man who expects a woman to understand the philosophy of dinner-giving shows the strongest evidence of a low mind. He is unjust towards that lovely and delicate creature, woman, to suppose that she heartily understands and cares for what she eats and drinks. No. Taken as a rule, women have no real appetites. They are children in the gourmandizing way, loving sugar, sops, tarts, trifles, apricot creams, and such gewgaws. They would take a sip of Malmsey, and would drink currant wine just as happily, if that accursed liquor were presented to them by the butler. Did you ever know a woman who could lay her fair hand upon her gentle heart, and say on her conscience, that she preferred dry Sillery to sparkling champagne? Such a phenomenon does not exist. They are not made for eating and drinking, or, if they make a pretense to it, become downright odious. Nor can they, I am sure, witness the preparations of a really great repast without a certain jealousy. They grudge spending money as guards, coachmen, and waiters. Whether this be not the case, they will give their all, heaven bless them, to serve a son, a grandson, or a dear relative, but they have not the heart to pay for small things magnificently. They are jealous of good dinners, and no wonder. I have shown in a former discourse how they are jealous of smoking and other personal enjoyments of the male. I say, then, that Lady Poxon or Mrs. Snorter can never conduct their husband's table properly. Fancy either of them consenting to allow a calf to be stewed down into gravy for one dish, or a dozen hares to be sacrificed to a single puree of game, or the best Madeira to be used for a sauce, or half a dozen of champagne to boil a ham in. They will be for bringing a bottle of Marsala in place of the old particular, or for having the ham cooked in water. But of these matters of kitchen philosophy I have no practical or theoretic knowledge, and must beg pardon if, only understanding the goodness of a dish when cooked, I may have unconsciously made some blunder regarding the preparation. Let it, then, be set down as an axiom, without further trouble of demonstration, that a woman is a bad dinner caterer, either too great and simple for it, or too mean, I don't know which it is. And gentlemen, according as they admire or contemn the sex, may settle that matter their own way. In brief, the mental constitution of lovely woman is such that she cannot give a great dinner. It must be done by a man. It can't be done by an ordinary man, because he does not understand it. Vain fool! and he sends off to the pastry cook in Great Russell Street or Baker Street. He lays on a couple of extra waiters, greengrocers in the neighborhood. He makes a great poker with his butler in the cellar, and fancies he has done the business. Bon Dieu! Who has not been at those dinners? Those monstrous exhibitions of the pastry cook's art? Who does not know those made dishes with the universal sauce to each? Fricandeau, sweetbreads, damn dumpy cutlets, and sea, seasoned with a compound of grease, onions, bad port wine, cayenne pepper, curry powder, Warren's blacking, for what I know, but the taste is always the same. There they lie in the old corner dishes, the poor wiry moselle and sparkling burgundy in the ice coolers, and the old story of white and brown soup, turbot, little smelts, boiled turkey, saddle of mutton, and so forth. Try a little of that fricandeau, says Mrs. Snorter, with a kind smile. You'll find it, I think, very nice. Be sure it has come in a green tray from Great Russell Street. Mr. Fitzboodle, you have been in Germany, cries Snorter, knowingly. Taste the hock, and tell me what you think of that. How should he know better, poor benighted creature, or she, dear good soul that she is? If they would have a leg of mutton and an apple pudding, and a glass of sherry and port, or simple brandy and water called by its own name, after dinner, all would be very well, but they must shine, they must dine as their neighbors. There is no difference in the style of dinners in London. People with 500 a year treat you exactly as those of 5,000. They will have their moselle hock, their fatal side dishes brought in the green trays from the pastry cooks. Well, there is no harm done, not as regards the dinner givers at least, though the dinner eaters may have to suffer somewhat. It only shows that the former are hospitably inclined, and wish to do the very best in their power, good honest fellows. If they do wrong, how can they help it? They know no better. And now, is it not as clear as the sun at noonday, that A1 exists in London for a superintendent of the table, a gastronomic agent, a dinner master, as I have called him before? A man of such a profession would be a metropolitan benefit. Hundreds of thousands of people of the respectable sort, people in white waistcoats, would thank him daily. Calculate how many dinners are given in the city of London, and calculate the numbers of benedictions that the agency might win. And as no doubt the observant man of the world has remarked that the freeborn Englishman of the respectable class is, of all others, the most slavish and truckling to a lord, that there is no fly-blown peer, but he is pleased to have him at his table, proud beyond measure to call him by his surname without the lordly prefix, and that those lords whom he does not know, he yet, the freeborn Englishman, takes care to have their pedigrees, and ages by heart from his world Bible, the Erich. As this is an indisputable fact, and as it is in this particular class of Britons that our agent must look to find clients, I need not say it is necessary that the agent should be as high-born as possible, and that he should be able to tack, if possible, an honorable or some other handle to his respectable name. He must have it on his professional card, the Honorable George Gorman Gobbleton, Apician Chambers, Paul Mall, or Sir Augustus Carver Cramley Cramley, Amphitryonic Council Office, Swallow Street, or, in some such neat way, Gothic letters on a large handsome crockeryware card, with possibly a gilt coat of arms and supporters, or the blood-red hand of Baronetcy duly displayed. Depend on it, plenty of guineas will fall in it, and that Gobbleton's supporters will support him comfortably enough. For this profession is not like that of the auctioneer, which I take to be a far more noble one, because more varied and more truthful, but in the agency case, a little humbug at least is necessary. A man cannot be a successful agent by the mere force of his simple merit or genius in eating and drinking. He must of necessity impose upon the vulgar to a certain degree. He must be of that rank which will lead them naturally to respect him, otherwise they might be led to jeer at his profession. But let a noble exercise it, and bless your soul, all the art guide is dumb. He will then give out in a manly and somewhat pompous address what has before been mentioned, namely, that he has seen the fatal way in which the hospitality of England has been perverted hitherto, accompanied by a few cooks with green trays. He must use a good deal of French in his language, for that is considered very gentlemanlike by vulgar people. He will take a set of chambers in Canton Gardens, which will be richly though severely furnished, and the door of which will be opened by a French valet. He must be a Frenchman, remember, who will say, on letting Mr. Snorter or Sir Benjamin Poxon in, that Eiler is at home. Poxon will then be shown into a library furnished with massive bookcases, containing all the works on cookery, and wines, the titles of them, in all the known languages in the world. Any books, of course, will do, as you will have them handsomely bound, and keep them under plate glass. On a side table will be little sample bottles of wine, a few truffles on a white porcelain saucer, a prodigious strawberry or two, perhaps, at the time when such fruit costs much money. On the library will be busts marked Oud, Karim, Bechamel, in marble, never mind what heads, of course, and, perhaps, on the clock should be a figure of the Prince of Conde's cook killing himself, because the fish had not arrived in time. There may be a wreath of immortelles on the figure, to give it a more decidedly Frenchified air. The walls will be of a dark rich paper, hung round with neat gilt frames, containing plans of menus of various great dinners, those of Cambaciers, Napoleon, Louis-Ziv, Louis-XVIII, Heliogabalus if you like, each signed by the respective cook. After the stranger has looked about him at these things, which he does not understand in the least, especially the truffles, which look like dirty potatoes, you will make your appearance, dressed in a dark dress, with one handsome enormous gold chain, and one large diamond ring, a gold snuff box, of course, which you will thrust into the visitor's paw, before saying a word. You will be yourself a portly grave man, with your hair a little bald and gray. In fact, in this, as in all other professions, you had best try to look as like canning as you can. When Poxon has done sneezing with the snuff, you will say to him, take a fodule. I have the honor of addressing Sir Benjamin Poxon, I believe? And then you will explain to him your system. This, of course, must vary with every person you address. But let us lay down a few of the heads of a plan which may be useful, or may be modified infinitely, or may be cast aside altogether, just as circumstances dictate. After all, I am not going to turn gastronomic agent, and speak only for the benefit perhaps of the very person who is reading this. Synopsis of the Gastronomic Agency of the Honorable George Gobbleton. The gastronomic agent, having traversed Europe, and dined with the best society of the world, has been led naturally, as a patriot, to turn his thoughts homeward, and cannot but deplore the lamentable ignorance regarding gastronomy displayed in a country for which nature has done almost everything. But it is ever singularly thus. Inherent ignorance belongs to man, and the agent, in his continental travels, has always remarked that the countries most fertile in themselves were invariably worse tilled than those more barren. The Italians and the Spaniards leave their fields to nature, as we leave our vegetables, fish, and meat. And, heavens, what richness do we fling away, what dormant qualities in our dishes do we disregard, what glorious gastronomic crops, if the agent may be permitted the expression, what glorious gastronomic crops do we sacrifice, allowing our goodly meats and fishes to lie fallow. Chance, apostrophe it is said by an ingenious historian, who, having been long a secretary in the East India House, must certainly have had access to the best information upon Eastern matters. Chance, apostrophe it is said by Mr. Charles Lamb, which burnt down a Chinaman's house, with a litter of sucking pigs, that were unable to escape from the interior, discovered to the world the excellence of roast pig. Apostrophe apostrophe gunpowder, we know, was invented by a similar fortuity. The reader will observe that my style in the supposed character of a gastronomic agent is purposely pompous and loud.
Oh, 'tis said, was printing, so glass. We should have drunk our wine poisoned with the villainous odor of the Borachio, had not some eastern merchants, lighting their fires in the desert, marked the strange composition which now glitters on our sideboards, and holds the costly produce of our vines. We have spoken of the natural riches of a country. Let the reader think, but for one moment, of the gastronomic wealth of our country of England, and he will be lost in thankful amazement as he watches the astonishing riches poured out upon us from nature's bounteous cornucopia. Look at our fisheries. The trout and salmon tossing in our brawling streams, the white and full-breasted turbot struggling in the mariner's net, the purple lobster lured by hopes of greed into his basket prison, which he quits only for the red ordeal of the pot. Look at whitebait, great heavens! Look at whitebait, and a thousand frisking, glittering, silvery things besides, which the nymphs of our native streams bear kindly to the deities of our kitchens such as they are. And though it may be said that other countries produce the freckle-backed salmon and the dark broad-shouldered turbot, though trout frequent many a stream besides those of England, and lobsters sprawl on other sands than ours, yet, let it be remembered that our native country possesses these altogether, while other lands only know them separately. That, above all, whitebait is peculiarly our country's, our city's own. Blessings and eternal praises be on it, and, of course, on brown bread and butter. And the Briton should further remember, with honest pride and thankfulness, the situation of his capital, of London. The lordly turtle floats from the sea into the stream, and from the stream to the city. The rapid fleets of all the world see don and rendezvous in the docks of our silvery Thames. The produce of our coasts and provincial cities, east and west, is borne to us on the swift lines of lightning railroads. In a word, and no man but one who, like the agent, has traveled Europe over, can appreciate the gift. There is no city on earth's surface so well supplied with fish as London. With respect to our meats, all praise is supererogatory. Ask the wretched hunter of Cheverel, the poor devourer of Rebreton, what they think of the noble English haunch, that, after bounding in the park of Knoller Windsor, exposes its magnificent flank upon some broad silver platter at our tables. It is enough to say of foreign venison, that they are obliged to lard it. Away! Ours is the palm of roast, whether of the crisp mutton, that crops the thymy herbage of our downs, or the noble ox who revels on lush Althorpian oil cakes. What game is like to ours? Man's excels us in poultry, 'tis true, but 'tis only in merry England that the partridge has a flavor, that the turkey can almost see passer de truffes, that the jolly juicy goose can be eaten as he deserves. Our vegetables, moreover, surpass all comment. Art, by the means of glass, has wrung fruit out of the bosom of nature, such as she grants to no other clime. And if we have no vineyards on our hills, we have gold to purchase their best produce. Nature, and enterprise that masters nature, have done everything for our land. But, with all these prodigious riches in our power, is it not painful to reflect how absurdly we employ them? Can we say that we are in the habit of dining well? Alas, no. And the agent, roaming o'er foreign lands, and seeing how, with small means and great ingenuity and perseverance, great ends were effected, comes back sadly to his own country, whose wealth he sees absurdly wasted, whose energies are misdirected, and whose vast capabilities are... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.